Welcome to the Fly Fishing Rocky Mountain National Park podcast reference series, helping you get the most out of your fly fishing experience in the park. Whether you've fished the park many times or you're planning your very first trip, the reference series podcast will certainly have something to make your next trip more successful and memorable. Hi, I'm Steve Schweitzer, author of A Fly Fishing Guide to Rocky Mountain National Park. Let's get right to today's podcast.
Hi, I'm Steve Schweitzer, and I have a very special guest today, Dick Shinton, who is a longtime guide in the park. Dick, welcome to the podcast.
I'm pleased to be part of it, Steve.
Dick, why don't you share with us a little bit about your bio and your background and give us a flavor of who you are.
Okay. I came out of the high-tech world as a human resources executive, so I sort of caught into people naturally. I think most of that experience stood me in good stead, especially all the training experience I had. I started fly fishing about 35 years ago, but I did it off and on because I was self-taught, and I would get really frustrated because I wasn't successful. And it wasn't until about 10 years ago that I decided, when I moved back to Colorado from Oregon, that it was one of the things that I wanted to get serious about. And so I started hanging out at a shop here in Longmont that no longer exists, and met a lot of great people, and went fishing with them and got a lot of great instruction from people like Dale Darling and Frank Drummond and Tom Maydew and others who helped me learn the craft of fly fishing and fly tying and so forth. So that's really how I got my start in fly fishing. As far as guiding goes, Frank Drummond said to me one day, you know, you ought to be a guide. And it was nothing that I had ever aspired to. I asked him why he thought that was possible for me, because I never considered myself to be a very good fisherman. And he explained that being a good guide is really more about teaching than it is about your own fishing. Obviously, you have to know the basics, but most importantly, you have to be able to transfer that knowledge to other people.
Yeah, and I think you've demonstrated that both on and off the court, so to speak. You know, you work a lot with the local youth initiatives. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Sure. In conjunction with our fly shop, the Laughing Grizzly, and our local Trout Unlimited chapter, St. Vrain Anglers, I do a Kids Learn to Fly Fish program every spring. It has room for 12 kids between the ages of 8 and 13, and we do 6 Saturday morning sessions. 3 on fly tying, closely linked to entomology, because I believe that one of the things that differentiates good fly fishers from those who are not so good is an understanding of bugs. So we hit them right away with entomology. We do in our 4th session a wrap-up of that with a wonderful video called Bugs of the Underworld, and we then talk about the Trout Unlimited mission and some of our local projects, some of our local challenges on the St. Vrain and the Big T and in the park and so forth, and how we can help as an organization to do that. Then we go out to the South St. Vrain River with Josh Rickard as our leader, and he helps us bring that world of bugs to life. We get out there with our big seines in the river, and the kids are really enthusiastic then. They know their bugs pretty well by then, so we have them sort them out, you know, into mayflies, stoneflies, caddisflies, and that sort of thing, into ice cube trays. And so they take pictures, they take a few of them home, and they love that. And then we finish it up with a casting lesson and fishing. By the time we finish up, it's too early in the year to really go have much luck with trout fishing. So we take them to local ponds. Yeah. Where they can catch bluegills.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I can tell you're certainly passionate about that. It's a great initiative here in the local community. And you mentioned Josh Rickard, who we're going to have on an upcoming episode, and he's a great resource for entomology.
He is.
Yeah. So, I tell you what, let's jump right into the business of guiding.
Okay.
And really the purpose of today's podcast is to understand, what does a guide do to help out a client or a set of clients?
Okay.
How do they prepare? And what can clients expect of a guide? And so, let's start with the basics. What is a guide? What do they do?
Well, it's in its simplest form, a guide is simply somebody who takes you someplace to go fishing. But there are lots of different kinds of guides who work with different kinds of fly fishers. And I'll limit my comments to fly fishing because there's lots of other guides who do other kinds of things.
Yeah.
Most of our clientele are relatively inexperienced fly fishers. And I would say that that's probably true for most people who guide in the park. We get something like 3 million visitors a year to the park.
Yeah.
Most of them are from somewhere other than Colorado. And oftentimes a fly fishing trip is an afterthought. What happens to us at the shop frequently is we'll get a phone call and say, my dad's coming into town next week. Can you take him fishing? He's always wanted to do that. So you can expect, in those kinds of situations, you ought to expect that your guide can teach you how to do it. A guide should know the basics of casting, should know some basics, the basics of entomology, should be able to help you look at a stream and determine where the fish are likely to be, help you learn how to manage your line on the water, and to land fish when that time comes. And also, of course, there's the whole thing about flies and relating those to the insects and sure. those kinds of things, too.
Sure. So what are the top 3 to 5 qualities a guide should possess to be a good guide?
Number one is patience. you just have to be a person who can go with the flow, roll with the punches, and all those other good cliches. Some people are, people have different learning styles, and some people work best with a very directive style, and so you have to tell them and guide them through every single step. Other people like to be just told one time and be left alone to try it on their own, and you have to figure that out. Sometimes they'll try your patience. So I would say patience is the number one quality. Number two is you have to be able to... You not only have to know how to cast yourself, but you have to understand the dynamics of what makes a cast work and what the rod does, and you have to be able to translate that to people in a way that they'll understand it. I mean, I can give you a pretty close physics-based explanation of why rods work the way they do, and that works for a lot of people. But for a lot of people, that doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, so you have to be able to find a way to transfer that information to your client.
Yeah, the way they want to listen.
The way they want to listen, the way they're going to learn the best. And I would say, at least for myself, I don't sort of stand back and say, okay, well, what do I need to do? How's this person going to learn? How is this person going to use the information I give them? It's a more intuitive thing, I think, that you get from working with people.
Yeah. Anything else? Anything else that a guide needs to know to be a really good guide?
Well, they certainly need to know where to go fishing. That's for sure.
Yeah, that's the fly shop secret, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Well, good. What do you think makes a good learner when you have a client out? What qualities should a client have or exhibit when they're being taught?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I'll be really flippant first off and say it helps to be a woman, because most guides will tell you that women are better listeners than most men. And now, obviously, that's not true for everybody.
Yeah.
Learners, people who intend to learn how to fly fish, need to pay attention to what their guides are saying them and try as best they can to take what that guide's trying to show them and teach them and be serious about it. I think most guides would tell you that their toughest clients are those who are more experienced, not necessarily experts, but more experienced people who think they know how it works and frankly just don't listen very well.
Yeah. I've heard that comment many times, that the experienced ones are the toughest.
Yes.
Women are the best.
Mm-hmm.
And kids are the easiest.
Yes. And kids are great. Kids are used to taking direction from adults. So that helps a lot.
Yeah.
But And I'll say, too, in our, we already talked about how much I love working with kids. I also am a counselor for the Colorado Child Unlimited Youth Camp for teenage kids every year. And in our shop, I'm sort of known as the go-to guy for kids. And so if we have kids on guide trips, I often wind up with those those trips because I love how kids approach the world.
Yeah, it's almost, there's nothing better or more rewarding than to have a young kid catch his first or her first fish on a fly rod. Mm. I've experienced that a few times, particularly with my own family.
Mm-hmm.
Super rewarding.
Yep.
It's just as if you caught the fish yourself.
Exactly.
So, well, good. You know, if someone's never fished the park, which you say most of the clientele you get are like that, how do they go about getting a guide? What do they do when they call up a fly shop?
Well, let's talk on a higher level first, because I'm not sure that people always think about calling a shop to find a guide. I think a lot of people get recommendations about shops and about guides from friends and family and so forth. I think that word spreads pretty well, and I know I get a lot of clients as references from past clients. I think all of the guides in our shop do. So I think for somebody looking for a guide, I think one of the best things they can do is ask their friends, ask their fly fishing friends who they know that might be good, or what shop has a good reputation.
Yeah.
And because some shops, frankly, are better than others in terms of the quality of the guides they hire and the way they manage their guides and the way they treat their clients.
Yeah.
I think you can do these days, certainly the internet is a great way to do searches for shops that have guide services. And I would say that clients should not at all be afraid to call that shop and be very explicit about if they know how they like to work with a guide, to be very explicit about that, to ask questions, to ask the shop owner, who would you recommend? Who's the best guide on your staff to do X? If you have the opportunity to interview the guide, do that too.
Yeah, that's a great suggestion. Not oftentimes will you have that opportunity. They're often on the water. But but if they're in the shop, which most of them do kind of hang around the shop, you can talk to them live.
Right.
So let's say I'm going to talk to you. I called you up and I'm interviewing you. What should I ask you? What should I expect of you?
I think you want to talk to that guide about how he or she has worked with clients like you in the past. So you should be honest about your skill level and ask how a guide would work with you on that. Or if you if there's something in particular you want to learn about, maybe you want to learn about hatches in Rocky Mountain National Park, or maybe you want to know about the best places to go catch greenback cutthroats. We'll tell you some of them. You have a reason for going that probably is more than just I want to go fishing. You may have a particular thing that you want to learn about. I mean, I've had clients who when we get to the Marine Park area, for example, look up on the South Lateral Moraine and see all those brown trees, and they want to know about that. And they have a thirst to learn about nature. So they'll ask you about, well, how did this valley get made? You know, when were the glaciers here? And, and that kind of stuff. So, figure out what it is you want to get out of the trip and ask questions that will get you that information.
Yeah, great advice. I remember when I went through guide school, one of the top qualifiers of a good guide was you have to be a conversationalist. Which means you have to be a historian, a geologist, an anthropologist, a birder.
Yes.
You have to know all of it. When we're in Rocky Mountain National Park, for example, you're going to see all of that. You're going to see elk and deer and moose and beaver and eagles. And you've got to know about all these things and be able to share history and facts about these. So.
Yes. One of the things I like about working in the park and with the park staff just so happens that last night we had our annual guide meeting. And that's one of the things that the Park Service stresses, is that those of us who guide in the park are extensions of the ranger staff. And they encourage us strongly to be aware of and be able to explain to our clients in the park about the wildlife, about the birds, and about geology and the history of the park, and who were some of these people like Enos Mills and others who were important in the history in the history of the park, and they follow that up by giving us information. They do a nice presentation that tells us about wildlife, what's going on with the elk management program, for example, what are we doing to manage the beetle kill problem, and so on and so forth. So we're able to help the park staff by making what's really, you know, a guide trip about fishing into a better experience.
An educational experience for
clients.
Absolutely. I really like the concept that you brought up about being an extension of the Park Service, yeah. Because you are.
And, sure. And I, you know, I'm older than the average guide, so I'm not so sure how some of the younger guides feel about that, but I certainly take that responsibility very, very seriously. And I've often said to people about how lucky we are to live within not much more than a half an hour of such a wonderful resource. This is a place where people come from all over the world to see.
Yeah.
And I have a lot of pride in sharing that resource with people.
Absolutely.
And it's real special for me to be able to do that.
Yeah.
Can I tell you a little anecdote about that?
I would love to hear it.
Okay. I had a client a couple years ago, an Englishman about my age, very eccentric guy, who was also, he was very interesting. He told me he wanted to see a coyote. So I decided that we would fish in Moraine Park area. He was also very inexperienced, and that's a great place to take beginners. Not very many trees. And
exactly.
So we were driving down off the North Lateral Moraine, getting down into the floor of the moraine right by the museum there. And there was a car in front of me, and I was sort of cursing under my breath about the woman hanging out the window taking pictures until I realized that what she was taking pictures of was a coyote. So, and there's more coyotes in Moraine Park probably than anywhere else in the park. And so I said to my client, there's your coyote. Well, not only did the coyote come down the hill, trotted across the road, he stopped about 10 feet off the shoulder of the road in the Moraine Park, and he started digging. He came up with a ground squirrel, and he ate it in front of us. Now, what an experience, not only for my client, but certainly for me. I'd never seen anything like that except on TV. So those kinds of things are what make the park special.
Yeah, and you got lucky, and you were the hero guide of the day.
Yeah, I was.
Yeah, that's great. As a guide, you do a lot of work, a lot of homework, a lot of preparation before each trip.
Mm-hmm.
Can you share with me what your day looks like?
Sure.
I'm going to meet you at 8 a.m. at Estes, and we're going to go out guiding. What mm-hmm. do you do to prepare for that?
Okay, well, the night before, I'll make sure my car is full of gas.
Yeah.
I will go to the grocery store, and if I don't already have a stack of munchies to take along, I'll make sure I have enough of that stuff, make sure my stock of water is up. If we're going to be out over lunch, I'll buy food for lunch, and I'll spend some prep time the night before. I like to make I don't use sliced bread, so I like to make sandwiches out of better breads, and so I'll slice
with you. That's delicious.
I'll slice the bread, and I'll usually I know people like lettuce and tomatoes on their sandwiches, so I'll slice that stuff up, and I get that all prepped the night before. So in the morning, I don't have to be worrying about that. All I have to do is actually make the sandwiches. I always have a good supply of those little mustard and mayonnaise packets to take along,
sure.
too. And so I want to make sure that my clients have a nice homemade sandwich. It wasn't some, you know, some of the other guides have told me about, well, you know, you can get sandwiches at Safeway for $2 a piece. Well,
yeah.
To me, that doesn't cut it.
Yeah.
I want to have something a little bit better. I always have fresh fruit. I always have something sweet and a good sandwich and some better quality munchie bars like Lara bars or, you know, those kinds of things.
Sure.
Along for snacks. So that's most of that's the night before. First thing in the morning then is prep. If it's a cold day like I had like yesterday when I had a trip, I made two thermoses full of coffee to take along and made sure I had creamer and sugar and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Get to the shop about a half an hour or so before the trip. Check out the my clients need rods, I need to check those rods and reels, make sure they've got good leaders on them. If not, I've got to replace those. I've got to make sure I got the right flies. I usually do that the night before, too. Yeah. I use almost exclusively my own flies for guiding.
Yeah.
But if there's anything special I want to take, I make sure I grab that at the shop. Make sure I have enough basic supplies in my vest, you know, tippet and floatant and split shot and all those consumables that you got to have. So I would say for the average guide trip, even a four-hour trip, you spend probably a half an hour to an hour per hour of trip time getting ready.
Yeah.
So, you know, a four-hour trip probably takes me two to three hours of prep time when it's all said and done.
And boy, in the busy season, when you're doing back-to-back-to-backs, and you do, you know, 11, 12 trips days in a row and no break, that gets to be a routine.
Yeah, it does. It does.
Yeah.
You're tired after that time.
Yeah. Well, and let me understand this, just to be clear. So all that water, all that sandwich fixings, all that healthy stuff, apples and power bars and whatnot, that's out of your own pocket.
That's out of my pocket. That's right. That's right. Now, of course, we get paid by the shop for doing the trip.
Yeah.
Some shops do contribute some funds for lunches. Some don't, but they certainly don't cover it all. I mean,
right.
The best I've heard is like $5.
You know, which
yesterday, I had a six-hour trip. At the night before at the grocery store, I spent $17.
Yeah. Today's prices, that's what you get for good quality food.
That's right.
So what determines when you bring the extra goodies along or not? I mean, a half-hour or half-day trip doesn't get a sandwich.
Right, yeah. A four-hour trip is just munchy stuff. So I always bring, you know, the better quality bars. One of my favorites is cocoa-covered almonds. That makes a great snack. Everybody loves that. Milano cookies. That's another great one.
So wow, you have some nice stuff.
All those, you know, people appreciate those a little bit better kinds of things instead of like a bag of peanuts or something like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's really important to me, and I think it is to most guides, that your clients have a good time. They have a memorable time. They're spending good money to go out and do this. And I also believe most guides do it for their love of it and not to make money. The only places guides really make money is on the big time destination fly fishing places like the Bighorn and the Green and those kinds of places where, you know, those guys are out there in drift boats and so on and so forth. You can make a living doing that.
Yeah.
But you can't make a living doing what we do in the park. You do it for the love of it.
Yeah. So there's a lot of work that goes into being a guide before each trip, let alone the meetings that you have to prepare for the season.
Right.
The certifications you have to get.
Yes.
Talk to me a little bit about that.
Okay. You are required by park rules, and I think, well, in Colorado, let me sort of start over. In Colorado, a guide must either be or work for a Colorado registered outfitter. And you are required by law to be certified in first aid and CPR. And the park requires that as well. So most certifications these days are for 2 years. So at least every 2 years you have to go and get recertified. And that comes out of your pocket too. Most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And And you, besides just having to take that class, you have to pay attention because sometimes you take out clients who have medical problems. You got to be prepared to handle those kinds of things.
Yeah.
So I've been lucky. I've never had a medical emergency on a trip. But
that's pretty important given the altitude that we fish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is.
Now, you know, being a guide, there are days when you don't want to be a guide. How do you handle that?
Well, you have to, it's like, I think it's probably like working at Disneyland, where it doesn't matter how you feel, you're there as a form of entertainment in a way. And so if you're sick, or if you've got a headache, or you just had a big fight with your girlfriend or whatever, you have to just put that behind you for that time, because your client expects somebody who's got a positive attitude about the mission you're about to embark on to learn about fly fishing. And so you're on stage. I worked for a fly shop in Estes Park for a couple of years, and the owner of that shop always said, remember, this is entertainment.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you have to be on your game whether you want to be or not.
Exactly.
And that's part of a guide's job.
Exactly.
Yeah. Do you take your clients to the same water every day?
No. I tailor where I take them to their skill level, for one thing. I love Glacier Creek. Arguably maybe my favorite stream in the park. But for the most part, Glacier Creek is not a great place to take beginners. It's a little close in there. I mean, there are places on Glacier where you can take people, take beginners, but by and large, it's tough. I mean, the lower end of Glacier Creek in the area we call Tuxedo, down near the confluence with the Big T, that's tough fishing water down there.
You got to be close.
Accurate.
You mean,
I mean, it's close in. You got trees right up to the banks and so forth.
Yeah.
And so you have to be a better than average caster to be successful down there. So I would only take somebody who's more experienced in a place like that. There are places on the upper Big Thompson where I would be more comfortable only taking more experienced fishermen. I don't mean experts, but people at least who know how to handle their rod and aren't going to be getting hung up in trees all the time and so on and so forth. Beginners I really like to take on some of the more open waters. The part of the Big Thompson above Cub Lake Trailhead is a great place for beginners.
Yeah.
Moraine Park and the side stream that a lot of people refer to as Cub Creek is a great place for beginners. We all have our favorites for beginners.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah.
And more experienced people.
When you're not guiding,
mm-hmm.
Where does a guide go?
I really like to fish on Upper Glacier Creek. And when I say Upper Glacier Creek, I mean above Alberta Falls.
Yeah, a little bit of a hike.
From Glacier Gorge. So it's not a long, walk.
No, not at all.
But the stream up there gets fairly small, tight quarters. Some places it's in little slot canyons that you can't really even get down into.
Yeah, that's right.
A lot of places you might fish 30 or 40 feet of stream, and then you have to climb out, go over a big hump of rocks, and then get back down. So you have a lot of scrambling around. But you're rewarded with a lot of beautiful little brook trout up there and the occasional greenback. And so that's where I often go when I'm on my own.
Yeah.
But I will say Upper Big Thompson above the Fern Lake Trailhead is another one of my favorites. I think it's one of the most...
don't give away all the secrets.
One of the most beautiful places in the park. Last year there was a young resident moose up there, and so it was fun seeing him, because historically there have not been moose in that
area.
That's right. And so other than to say that stretch of the river is one of my favorites, I won't say anything more about it, but there's some beautiful water up in there.
Lots of water to fish over 200 miles in the park, and you've touched upon some of my favorites as well.
Yeah.
What are some of your flies, the favorite flies that you like in the park? Actually, one of my favorite flies is one that you created. They used to be Emerger, which is in the book.
Yeah.
I believe it's on laughfinggrizzly.com website.
Yes, it is.
I can't recall, but
yeah.
actually tell us a little bit how that came about, and then tell me some of your other flies you like.
Okay, well, the used to be has its name because, frankly, it's a ripoff of Charlie Craven's Jujubee fly. And I was looking for an easier way to tie that fly because I don't like working with super hair, and Charlie does, and I wanted it to have a trailing shuck and a few other odds and ends, and that sort of led me to experimenting around till I came up with this version that uses stripped peacock curl on the abdomen. So, and it's turned out to be a great emerger pattern. I fish it behind a lot of flies because it will sink just about an inch into the film. But other flies, well, I'm a big fan of Parachute Adams, Elk Hair Caddis. In the last few years, I've become a big, big fan of your Taboo Caddis Emerger. That's a great, great fly.
Yeah, I
have caught fish on that so many ways, trailing it behind a dry fly or fishing it deep behind a beadhead nymph. It's a great pattern. Another fly that I fish a lot and have a great deal of success with is a pattern given to me by Josh Stevens, who is a member of the U.S. National Fly Fishing Team, called the Tar Heel Caddis, and named that because Josh is from North Carolina, and it's a simple little case caddis pattern. A lot of these flies are what we refer to as guide flies because they take very little time to tie, and they're reliable, you know.
Yeah.
Pink San Juan worm. You know, when I first started guiding about 5 years ago, we were all using what we referred to as Barney, a purple San Juan worm. And one day I was fishing, and I ran out of purple San Juan worms, and I had some pink ones. And I put on a pink one. I'd never fished one before. And I started catching fish like crazy. And so I switched over and used it and started using it more and more and more. And I started talking it up among my fellow guides. And I guess if I have any claim to fame, I'll claim some responsibility for the popularity of the pink San Juan worm in the park, because I've talked it up among other guides so much.
I can vouch for that, I'll tell you. So, the first I heard of it was through the grapevine, eventually leading towards you, and there was a 23-inch brown associated with that.
Yeah, that's right.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, that they're over on the Cub Creek side. Cub Creek is really an extension of that comes out of the Big Thompson up by the Cub Lake Trailhead. But because it looks on the map like it comes out of Cub Lake, people call it Cub Creek.
Yeah.
And so I was fishing over there one day. It was about 2 or 3 years ago. We had another big runoff like we're going to have this year. It was an old beaver pond with an old dam, and the water was flowing about 2 feet deep over the top of that dam. And you could just tell by looking at it that it wasn't going to last long. I'll bet that dam was probably 30 or 40 years old. It had no active beavers in it to keep, you know, to take care of it anymore. And the beaver pond was built on a curve, and the water on that one side where the main channel was probably 8 or 9 feet deep. And so I was just up on a day fishing by myself with no great expectations, had my three weight, had on a pink San Juan worm, ran it through that hole, thought I got stuck on the bottom, as sometimes happens with big fish, and I could tell right away it was a big guy. Luckily for me, he didn't make a big fuss. He kind of hung on the bottom, and he moved up and down that hole a little bit, but he mostly just stayed on the bottom and shook his head. I just kept steady pressure on him, and he came up, and I was very proud to take that picture of that fish with that pink San Juan worm in his mouth. So,
well, I use it in my presentations, and I speak very highly of a pink San Juan worm, and you in the same breath for sure. That's certainly one of the biggest trout I've seen taken out of the moraine. So,
I've certainly seen big trout in there before. I've had smaller fish that I was bringing in be attacked by big browns that came out from under banks. So I knew they were in there, but never expected to catch one. And I fully expect that's a once-in-a-lifetimer for me. You know, I doubt I'll ever see another one. But I've been told by people in the know that if you go up there after dark in the marine with big streamers and mouse patterns, that one of those fish might be yours.
Yeah, well, big fish, big brown trout time is nighttime.
Yes.
In most any water here in Colorado. What type of equipment do you give to your clients who require equipment?
Mm-hmm.
And then the same question goes applies. If they wanted to bring their own equipment, what should they bring?
Mm-hmm. At the shop, we have 3-weight and 4-weight rods, short ones, 7.5 and 8-footers. A rod like that's just right for the park. You don't want a really long rod up there. Streams are small. A lot of places, as we talked about earlier, it's tight quarters, and you don't have a lot of room to maneuver, and a longer rod just gets in the way. So I would say the length is almost more important than the weight. If people were just going to go out on their own, I'd say take a 2-weight or 3-weight. That'll handle most any fish. You can catch in a stream. If you're going to fish in a lake, you probably want at least a 4-weight and maybe a 5-weight because you might encounter a lot of wind. You may need to make longer casts to cruising fish. And so a little bit of extra length, 9 feet, 9.5 feet, certainly isn't out of the question.
Yeah. What about waders and boots and stuff like that?
In our shop, we supply primarily Sims, but also some Reddington gear, both waders and boots. A lot of places in the park, you could certainly get by with hippers if you wanted to, but hippers are getting hard to find. And you don't want those old rubber things like you used to be able to buy at Garp Brothers or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
Because those are almost dangerous. But if you can find good quality hip boots, that'll serve you well most anywhere in the park. I love waist-high waders, and in the summertime, though, I like to wet wade.
Yeah. What else do they need to bring? Anything else that you recommend?
Yeah. Caps, polarized sunglasses, for sure. You can wear any old sunglasses. You want to reduce the strain on your eyes, and you want to protect your eyes against, sticks and branches and flies and all that kind of stuff. But polarized glasses will really help you be able to see the bottom of the stream, see fish in the stream.
Yeah.
And so that's real important. You should have sunscreen.
Now, would you have some of that with you as well?
I always have sunscreen and bug repellent with me, yes.
Excuse me.
But I'll tell you, these years when the water's high and there's big runoff and it gets, well back away from the river into the bushes, you end up with standing water, and those are mosquito factories.
Yeah.
We don't have a West Nile problem in the park, but, boy, some years, June and July, are just mosquito hell up there.
So what else would someone want to prepare with when they come to meet the guide for the first time on their first trip in the park?
Okay. Well, the way you're dressed is really important. Basics, you want something on your head, a cap. A lot of people like a full-brim hat of some sort to protect their ears from the sun. You need to have sunscreen, insect repellent. You need to dress for the season. Layering is usually the best way to go, so that as it gets warmer, you can shed, and as it gets colder, you can add. You need to wear some sort of pants or long underwear that goes under your waders. Jeans are not very comfortable under waders. Even though modern waders are breathable, your jeans aren't, and they'll just absorb any sweat that you generate under your waders, and they become pretty uncomfortable and too warm. So you want to dress lightly. Modern zip-off lightweight pants are always a really good choice, I think, for under wader wear. Rain jacket in case you get some rain or some snow is always welcome to help keep you dry. I recommend that you buy those kinds of things in a size larger than you normally would, because you may be wearing it over something else.
Mm-hmm. And great advice.
I wear, my vest is actually a 2XL, and I would ordinarily just wear just a large.
Well, it's because you carry 30 fly boxes.
Oh, that's true, too.
And rain jackets for everyone.
Well, that's right. And because, I like to wear that same vest in the wintertime when I've got maybe a heavier jacket on and gloves and so on and so forth. And so it just fits a lot better and helps me in all seasons.
talk a little bit about safety here. Now, there's a lot of facets of safety in the park, and maybe you can share some.
Sure. I've made it a practice to always ask my clients, do you have any medical conditions I need to know about that allows them to tell me what they want me to know? There are hazards in the park. You're at high altitude. Some people are more resistant to altitude sickness than others, but I've had people get terrible splitting headaches even at like 9,000 feet. And of course, the remedy for that is get down lower, drink water, and so on and so forth. We live in an area where in the summertime, thunderstorms are just about guaranteed.
Yeah.
And so you need to know, you need to have an awareness of how quickly a thunderstorm can develop and what to do if you're caught out in an area and what to do to improve your chances of not getting hit by lightning.
Yeah.
Certainly I had a friend here from Germany a few years ago, up on Trail Ridge, the end of July, got in a terrible hail and snowstorm with lightning flashing all over the place. So you just never know what's going to happen. Weather is the biggest, I think, potential hazard.
Yeah.
In the fall, you want to keep yourself away from those big bull elk. It amazes me to see people walk up to a big couple of bulls, you know, going at it, antlers locked, trying to get up within 10 feet of them. It blows me away. Yeah, safety's a big deal. When I fish with little kids, I am Velcro to those kids, and I usually will hold onto their shirt collar with one hand while they're fishing in case they go down, which has happened plenty of times.
Yeah. So it's the end of the day. You wrap up with your client, and you talk about what you saw and what you learned, the fish you caught, kind of have a few smiles and a few laughs. It's time to tip. And, guides do work for tips as well. That's a big portion of the reward of financial reward of guiding.
Right.
Can you give us some guidance on how someone should tip?
Sure. I think guiding is like most other personal services. If you've had a massage and you want to tip your monsieur or masseuse, you have a great meal in a restaurant and your waitress or waiter treated you well and attended to you well and made sure that your needs were met, 20% has come to sort of be the norm for those kinds of personal services. And I think when a guide is tipped, that's the sort of rule of thumb they use to say, I did a good job, or maybe I could have done better, or whatever. And the few times when you don't get tipped, when you get stiffed, as service people would say, it's usually because of a lack of knowledge. So if we don't get tipped well, we would like to know why. I always ask the owner of our shop, if I don't get a very good tip, I always ask him to follow up with that client and ask why. Was it something I did?
Well, you know, Dick, I really appreciate the time you spent with me today. And I'll just recap real quick. You work for Laughing Grizzly Fly Shop. There are other guide services that work the park that are very reputable.
Absolutely.
Go to my website, flyfishingrmnp.com. You'll see a complete listing there. There's a lot of great guides with super knowledge about the park from many of the fly shops. So feel free to email me. I'd be happy to help you out if you're looking for a guide this summer. And Dick, thanks again for joining me on this podcast.
It was absolutely a pleasure.
Join us for our next podcast as we talk with Josh Rickard covering basic entomology in the park. If you want to learn more about the bugs in the park and the flies to imitate them, you'll not want to miss this show. In the meantime, visit his webpage at rockymountainflyfisher.com to view the extensive information he has on bugs in the park. If you have questions or need more information about today's podcast, email me by going to flyfishingrmnp.com and click on the contact link. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.
Just let this noise.
This is a gas station or a fire station or something.
Yeah. So I'll start over with the whole question.
Yeah. Okay.
That'll be picked up.
Yes. I'm taking care of the other.
Copy. Do you guarantee fish?
Never.
Load.